Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome, listeners, to the New Books in African Studies podcast. My name is Paul Bjerk, and I'm here with Julie MacArthur, who is the author and editor of a new volume named Dedan Kimathi on Trial, Colonial Justice and Popular Memory in Kenya's Mau Mau Rebellion, published by The Ohio University Press in 2017. Julie is with me. Julie, thanks for being here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. I am Julie MacArthur. I'm an assistant professor of African history at the University of Toronto. And I've been working in the field for just over a decade now. I didn't start in Mau Mau history, but the coincidences and happenstance of research took me into this area where I ended up working on this project on Dedan Kimathi, which is the subject of this new book.
Okay. Well, what were you researching that brought you around to Dedan Kimathi and this central issue in Kenyan history? What were you doing prior to that?
So my doctoral work and then my first book, which is called Cartography and the Political Imagination, focused on Western Kenya and the making of ethnic communities in the colonial period, and particularly the impact of cartography and mapping on how people articulated their identities, how they fought back against colonialism, how they policed their own communities and sort of projected their own ideas about sovereignty and history through mapping and territorial practices. And through that work, I was exposed to a lot of different kind of historical themes and questions and figures. I became very interested in particular in a movement in Western Kenya called Dini Amasambwa, which is an anti-colonial rebellion that emerges in the 1940s in Kenya, particularly in Western Kenya. So this predates the Mau Mau Rebellion. And the leader of that movement, a prophet named Elijah Masinde, was sort of famously unrecorded. His voice, his words were never recorded. He was a prophet. And so everything that we knew about him was sort of through word of mouth, through what others had said about him. And one day in the archives, I discovered the transcript from his trial. And this was a 500-page document where he was speaking into the record. And not only was he speaking into the record, but he acted as his own defense. And so he provided this rich archival material that is the only record of his spoken words. They're in the context of a deportation trial, but he worked in the judicial system before he launched this rebellion. And so he was very well aware of the fact that this would be one of the only archival traces of his voice. And this document, 500-page document, had never been used by a historian because it was mislabeled in the archives. The name was recorded as Marinde. And so other scholars who had worked on Dini Amasambwa or on Elijah Masinde had perhaps missed or not found this rich document. And this really fascinated me, and I was very interested in this anti-colonial movement and its connections to Mau Mau, its connections to larger policies of colonial counterinsurgency and territorial containment during the 1940s and 50s. And through that process sort of became interested in the random stories I was hearing about everyone in Kenya knows the figure of Dedan Kimathi. He looms large. His image is on all the buses, on graffiti on walls, on t-shirts. So you know about Dedan Kimathi. But what I started to hear rumors about was the fact that his trial, which famously leads to his execution in 1957, had never been seen by anyone, by historians, by anyone in the public, by very famous politicians like J.M. Kadiuki, who requested the file in 1971, a few years before he's actually assassinated. No one had ever seen this document since his death. And so that sort of led me into asking, well, maybe I can just start poking around and looking for it.
Cool. So in other words, finding your way around the archive gave you a little confidence to track down other missing pieces of that archive.
I think what it revealed to me was that sometimes we're not asking the right questions to find the right sources. So Masindi's file being mislabeled reminded me to always look askew or look askance when you're in the archives, not just narrowly focus on what you're trying to find, but try to look around what you're trying to find. There's often richer and more material than we think, but we often sort of shut ourselves off and only take certain routes. Although the path to find the Kimathi file was a lot more daunting and ended up being a lot longer than my happenstance encounter with the Mumasinde file.
Great. Well, I'd like to ask you a couple questions just kind of before we dive into Mau Mau here about the nature of archives and also the nature of ethnicity. But let's start with ethnicity. How were people thinking about ethnicity and the construction of community in mid-century British colonial Africa, you know, according to your earlier research?
Yeah, so it's a very rich and complicated answer to that question, and certainly varies across the different landscapes in British colonies in Africa. What I was really interested in is the ways in which colonial rule kind of tried to set the terms for how people identified with different communities. So in the social construction argument around ethnicity, which sees all identities, national, ethnic, as being imagined and invented through various processes, within this theory, the colonial government sets the terms for how communities can become to be recognized. So historian John Iliff framed it this way. He said, that colonial officials believed all Africans belonged to tribes and Africans built tribes to belong. But John Lonsdale, another historian of Kenya, followed up saying no ethnicity, no identity can be invented or warmly shared in a historical void, and reminded us to think deeply about not only the process by which people come to identify as a community through writing their histories, through translating their languages, through practicing cultural rights, but also through these deeper histories and connections that have to be drawn in order to make this kinship real. In the case of Western Kenya, you had a kind of what was always seen as exceptional or sort of not fitting into the usual historical narrative about ethnicity. In Western Kenya, you have a community called the Luhya, who are today the second largest ethnic group in Kenya. But as an ethnic group, as one ethnic group, they did not exist prior to the 1930s. No one claims they existed before the 1930s. They do not share one language. They don't share a common myth of origin or ancestor, as many groups do. They don't share one set of cultural practices. And so I was really curious about how this group came to come together in this kind of cosmopolitan, diverse, plural sense of identity in the 1930s, why they chose to kind of group themselves together and how they sought to make claims on their on the colonial state, but also on their neighbors in order to discipline their own members of their community, in order to imagine different possibilities for sovereignty and for anti-colonial kind of movements and how they imagine themselves as a people within this period.
Cool. So, yeah. So, I mean, there's very much a very dynamic situation in Kenya at the time of people trying to imagine who they are and what they do, given the colonial context and what that might mean for their future. Go ahead.
Absolutely. No, the diversity among the Luhya, I do want to point out, though, is not actually exceptional in this period. Many people saw them as an exception and sort of didn't think they acted, still don't think they act like a proper tribe in Kenya. But if you take the case of language, missionary linguists who were working and translating the Bible into various African languages at the time found just as much diversity among the Gikuyu language as they did among the Luhya languages. And so this was a political process that many communities were going through. How do we deal with our diversity and create identities that are strong enough to sort of engage with the colonial state?
Cool. All right. And, you know, what you've mentioned on a number of occasions, I mean, this is in some ways at least the way historians encounter it. We encounter it via these colonial archives. Who is saving material and why are they saving material and what is the colonial archive and what is its relationship to kind of imperial archives and how do we understand what we find in these stores of documents?
Absolutely. It's a really important question. I always start by saying that with my students and with other researchers that I'm working with, that I don't consider the paper archive collected by a state to be the only example of the archives that we have access to. Many of us, including yourself, do oral history, which constitutes another kind of archive. I work a lot with personal archival holdings that people keep in their own houses, in their own homes, as well as multiple state and non-state documentary trails and also material culture. These different kinds of archives have different histories, have different genealogies. When you're thinking about the state archive, obviously this includes the power dynamic of the colonial state, but all archives are partial. All archives contain within them a history of why someone kept certain records, certain ideas, certain memories alive about her, these historical processes. And so there's a process of selection regardless of whether it's a colonial state.
So within all this work in archives, and as you mentioned before, you started to ask yourself, you know, how do we look laterally within the archive and think about what might be either missing or disappeared or deliberately disappeared or masked in various ways. So tell me how it is that when you decided to start looking for Kimathi's trial, what you found and what kind of breadcrumbs did you follow until you found it?
Right. It wasn't a straightforward process. It was in the summer of 2008 when I first started looking for the trial. And I had been having tea in Nairobi with two other scholars working on Kenya, David Anderson and Stacey Hind. And they started talking about their experiences in the High Court archives, which is now the Supreme Court of Kenya, and how these records are so rich. David Anderson wrote a very important study called Histories of the Hanged, which is based entirely on the trials of Mau Mau rebels, 1,090 of whom were sent to the gallows, Dedan Kimathi being among the most famous. And these trials provided such rich textual historical archival material for Anderson in that book. And yet they started talking about how difficult it was working in these archives, how partial they were, how often the evidence for a trial isn't kept. And they started talking about how they had seen glimpses of what they thought was the trial of Dedan Kimathi, but then either been removed or kicked out of the High Court or not allowed to investigate further into this. And this sort of sparked my interest. And with my experience with the Elijah Masinde trial transcript, I decided, well, I have a couple days in Nairobi, so why don't I go to the High Court? I haven't been, you know, I hadn't worked in that archive, so I was curious to see what they had. But also I thought, you know, sometimes just asking again can lead to a different result. In the summer of 2008, I think I had 3 or 4 days left in Nairobi. The first day I went to the Supreme Court and I was escorted to the head archivist, and they told me to bring official letter from my university. At the time it was the University of Cambridge. So I went online and found some letterhead for University of Cambridge and mocked up a letter. So I was a graduate student, so we don't have letterhead. And I brought it to the head archivist the same day. So she was very well aware that I was doing this across the street from the High Court. And she said, okay, come back tomorrow. And next day I was brought into this labyrinthine maze of underground tunnels where they keep archives sort of stacked, trial transcripts stacked from floor to ceiling. Mm-hmm. And I was brought into a room and the person told me to wait. They said the junior archivist wasn't there, so I had to go back. And the next day I came back, was led into a room. Everyone left the room and I looked on the table and there was something that for all intents and purposes, looked like the trial of Dedan Kamathi. So I, of course, got very excited, started copying all the file I could, started making copies. I'd heard stories about people having caught glimpses of the file and then it disappearing the next day. So I really wanted to take up as much of it as I could. And I was able to get a full record of it and was really taken in by not only the fact that this had been this missing part of the archive for so long, but also this remarkable story that the trial transcript told. It reads like a political thriller. There's a great chase scene. There's intrigue. There's legendary conflicted character at the center of it, and different forces sort of fighting it out in this battle. And so the narrative that I was getting from the trial not only was completely new and elements I'd never heard before, and certainly elements that I thought would be quite shocking if they were revealed, but also just this amazing story. As I, you know, sort of went back home and looked at the document more closely, consulted legal experts as well as other scholars, artifacts in the document became clear to me that this was not an authentic original copy.
Okay, well, let's stop for a minute. I mean, yeah. So what are you looking at here? So are these like sort of records of interrogations or kind of narratives of police reports, or what kind of material is in this trial transcript that was given you at the High Court in Kenya?
So in 2008, what I was given was a stack of single sheet paper that was purported to be and appeared to be a transcript of the trial proceedings. So not the evidence, not the interrogation, not the capture notes, none of that material, just exactly what happened during the trial.
So like cross examinations and things like that?
Exactly. The state presenting its case, the defense presenting its counter case, witnesses being called, Kamathi presenting his own case, and the judgment of the judge who was presiding over the case at the end. So that's what I was looking at. Certainly at that point it already seemed to contain more than I had ever known before, or had ever seen talked about before. But as I mentioned, looking at it more closely, there were artifacts that clearly meant this was not an authentic original document from the time period. The biggest red flag, which I should have noticed right away, but you get caught up in the excitement of the moment, especially as a young graduate student, was that at the top of the paper it said Republic of Kenya. And in 1956, there was no Republic of Kenya. Mm-hmm. Indeed, many thought independence was another 30, 40 years off. So this was clearly a document that had been created in the post-colonial period. The type of paper, the type of typescript, was clearly not in line with what I had seen of other trial documents at the time. Mm-hmm. And there were so many artifacts and typos and omissions and elisions in the document that I could not be certain how accurate it was. My assumption was that perhaps the document at some point, the original document, was being destroyed or being taken out of the archives and someone had rushed to transcribe it. The errors that I was noticing, the typographical errors, seemed to me to be auditory transcription errors, possibly someone reading it out and someone trying to type it out and maybe maintain a record. But I in all honesty, have no idea. And that document after 2008 also disappeared. Mm. So I have copies of it, but the one that was in the archive that I accessed disappeared by the next year.
Did it disappear? Or was it was just no, they would not release it to anybody anymore.
So it's a matter of trust. I worked very closely with the Supreme Court in this period. And when I get to the period of actually finding the authenticated trial, worked very, very closely with them. I believe that the archivists I was working with were incredibly genuine. If mm-hmm. there were other forces that disappeared the file, I am not aware of them. But I believe that the people I was working with had a great deal of integrity and desired the file to be found just as much as I did.
Which is interesting. I mean, but someone must have decided that it's no longer going to be
available. Things get misplaced. I've seen it happen many times where things just, a box gets put in the wrong space. These are chaotic archives often. This is in the basement where they still hold prisoners. and actually the Chief Justice at the time, now is the former Chief Justice, Willie Mutunga, who I worked with very closely, had been kept in one of those cells during the era of the Moi presidency. It's hard to trace whether, it's hard to believe that the document would have been missing for that long, considering how many copies would have been made originally and how many different places they should have been kept.
Right.
They should have been kept at the High Court, at the Court of Appeals, as well as in perhaps sites in London. It's hard to believe that all of those copies would go missing.
Is that what you started to think after realizing that this was somehow not the original copy? How did you come to think that there must have been more copies floating around out there? Or at what point did you realize that?
Well, speaking to people like Dave Anderson, who's worked so thoroughly in these kind of archives with these trials, mm-hmm. 8 to 9 copies was common. Okay. Of the original transcripts. And he kind of explained to me the various places he might find them. I was sort of going on this, as you said, lateral search, looking around these different archival spaces in Kenya, and not having a lot of success after that original file proved not to be authentic. Eventually, in 2015, I happened to be in London doing research for another project and visiting friends as well in Cambridge. And so I decided to follow the trail and see if there was any archival remnants from the two lawyers who served as Kamathi's defense for his final appeal to the Privy Council in London. So the lead lawyer was a very famous lawyer named Sir Dingle Foote, and his archives happened to be at Cambridge. So while I'm there visiting friends, it was very easy for me to pop over to Churchill College and talk to the archivist there. His archives were under 100-year closure, which means that anything in his files from the 1950s would not be able to be viewed until the 2050s. But I talked to the archivist and looked at the hand guide and looked at the material they had cataloged as being in his archives. And it didn't seem, and from talking to the archivist, it didn't seem like the trial transcript would be there. He certainly would have been sent a copy of the trial transcript to craft his appeal, but it didn't seem like he kept it in his personal documentation. And so I went to his second lawyer, his sort of junior lawyer at the time, Ralph Milner, and his archives had only recently been released to the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the Royal Senate Library. And I went and sort of started talking to the archivist, and he said no one had looked at Ralph Milner's archives yet. And he was a very famous anti-colonial lawyer, worked across the British colonial world defending various nationalists and trade unionists in the period, wrote on Soviet justice, and was seen as sort of an activist lawyer in the time. And started looking through the boxes of his files, and there it was. Just staring me in the face, and it had the proper file name. It had the embossed seal of Her Majesty as a Supreme Court of Kenya on the front. It was the right kind of paper. It had marginal notes from both the judge and Ralph Milner, the lawyer, which was quite remarkable. And it also had copies of the evidence, most of the pieces of evidence that were submitted by the state, which is incredibly rare to find for any colonial court case. Those are often destroyed after colonial court cases. And so this was just the most remarkable discovery. And in his long career, after defending dozens and dozens of anti-colonial figures across the British Empire, the Camathi file is the only one that was in his archives in its complete form. So it makes me wonder if he himself, he's passed now, but wonder if he himself saw some sort of value in this particular transcript, because he didn't keep any others. He really held on to just this one. So it was quite a fascinating find. We were then able to coordinate.
I mean, your historian's heart must have sort of dropped when you realized what you were looking at.
I mean, it's terrifying. You just you assume it's going to be taken away from you at any moment. So I'm madly taking photos of every page. I paid them to do a proper high resolution scan of each page, which I often never do because you can just take photos of archives. Right. It's the cheaper way to do it. But I wanted to make sure I had this archive in multiple forms. I put it on multiple different hard drives. I made sure to have copies in various places because it just seemed like such a precious document at this point that really existed nowhere else. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was able to coordinate with people in Kenya, in particular at the Supreme Court, and we had the file repatriated to Kenya. So there are copies available now in Kenya at the Supreme Court and at the Kenyan National Archives.
And how did the Kenyans, I mean, in particular, the people you were working with, what was their reaction when you gave them this news? What were their questions for you?
You know, there weren't really any questions. It was just the excitement.
Yeah.
It was just excitement. And really not even about the content, just about having this piece of the history. Some might see some of the aspects of the trial as contrary to the national image that's projected about Mau Mau or about Kimathi himself. But that didn't seem to be a concern. It was more, this was about a lost piece that was important in and of itself, regardless of what kinds of historical evidence or credence we can give to it. And as soon as I found it, all of a sudden, I arrived back in Nairobi a few weeks later, and Stanley Mutuma, who is a blind young archivist at the Supreme Court, calls me and says, "I've found something. I think you're going to want to come down to the court." So I go down and he has two boxes filled with all of the originals of the evidence from the trial. Still not a copy.
But the evidence was in the Kenyan, in the Supreme Court archive.
He found it in the basement of the appeals court.
Appeals court.
Yeah. But this is sort of bonus material. This is material we never see. So in the book, I'm able to reproduce an image of Dedan Kimathi's x-ray of his bullet wound. And this x-ray proves that the Home Guard, incontrovertibly proves, the judge agrees with this during the trial, proves the Home Guard who shot him was lying in his testimony. The trajectory of the bullet does not match his story. Mm-hmm. And the x-ray is in this pile of documents. What was also fascinating was in these two boxes was my letter from 2008, my own letter on Cambridge letterhead.
And so there was some active use of these boxes during all that period.
And I know multiple people who have submitted requests for this file, but there were only two requests in that box, mine and the late populist politician J.M. Kariuki. Very strange company to find myself in. So obviously these boxes had been utilized since this period. This hadn't been some forgotten thing, but all of a sudden we had original letters written by Kimathi in Gikuyu, the actual original letters. We had receipts from what the colonial state reimbursed his lawyer for his travel expenses. This kind of material. We had his execution warrant, which proves for the first time that he was, according to this record, buried in Kamiti prison. And that has been a long point of contention, and people are still trying to find his body. Indeed, a couple of months ago, there was another news story that his body had been discovered again. And of course, it turned out to be a hoax again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we now have a document that actually says that is where he was buried after his execution. So now this material was completely, this was material I wasn't even hoping to find. And all of a sudden the floodgates were opening.
Well, that's what my question is, do you think that your discovery in London and rumors or communication of that to Kenya had something to do with the sudden release of these other boxes?
It's difficult to say. There's sort of multiple layers at work in terms of who has access, who's doing the looking, who's allowed into certain spaces. There's even a joke I shared with Dave Anderson and Stacey Hind that I was given more access because I was at Cambridge and not Oxford. And the people at the Supreme Court like the Cambridge historians more than the Oxford historians. I mean, this is ridiculous kind of conjecture, but maybe it did play a role. Who knows? And so it's hard to tell if maybe this was some sort of, you know, releasing out, right? Which happens sometimes when states are faced with, you know, mounting evidence, they just kind of release everything and hope that the flood kind of overwhelms the narrative. Or if this was the dogged work of particular archivists who just kept looking and looking and looking and eventually were able to, get into those corners where perhaps they hadn't been allowed in a couple of years previous.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Wow. So we have this huge kind of pile of documents related to something that had been kind of hidden and mysteriously inaccessible for years and years and years, and yet surrounding all of this material, there had been an ongoing kind of mythology built up about Mau Mau and about Dedan Kimathi in particular. What is Mau Mau? How should we even start to understand that, and in particular in relation to this trial and this particular character, Dedan Kimathi?
That's a very big question.
Yes.
And I almost hesitate to answer because I'm not a Mau Mau scholar by training or by the field that I work in. I just have happened to stumble into the middle of the fray.
What did you find? So you had to read through this transcript.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And what's going on in that transcript? And then maybe we can get to what some of the big names in the field say about it, because they're also in your book. What did you find in this transcript?
Yeah, it was one of the first things I needed to do was to enlist people who'd been working in the field for a long time to contribute to this volume, because I knew myself I did not have necessarily the background or the skills to analyze it from all the angles that it deserved. The Mau Mau remains one of the most hotly contested aspects in African history. It has elicited some of the most heated debates among historians in terms of, and among the Kenyan public in terms of how it should be remembered, what kind of movement it was, whether it was fighting for national independence or was more of an internal struggle within the Kikuyu to define, you know, who should have legitimacy and authority and power and land, especially within this community. What kind of anti-colonial vision Mau Mau had. It was a very diverse movement. And indeed, that's the thing that struck me the most from the trial, and certainly something that John Lonsdale, one of the most important scholars on the moral economy of Mau Mau, writes about in his chapter in the book, is the way in which, as John puts it, the trial and the way Dedan Kimathi approached his defense in the trial put the internal moral arguments of the Mau Mau at the forefront of his defense. So you got to see the fissures, you got to see the breakdown, you got to see the different ways in which Kimathi positioned himself as a leader or not at different points within the movement. So the Mau Mau Rebellion has come to absorb a lot of the anxieties and different kinds of political voices at the time in the 1950s in Kenya. It is a movement that starts in central Kenya and is predominantly made up of people who come from the Kikuyu ethnic community, as well as the Embu and the Meru. And yet it has this sort of larger life in terms of being seen in the post-colonial period as kind of the freedom fighters, the liberation movement. So while it did not succeed in gaining independence, and while it's militarily defeated by the British, and that military defeat is really marked by the capture and trial and execution of Dedan Kimathi, while it doesn't succeed militarily, it's still seen as kind of a repository for the lost dreams of independence. And Kimathi certainly, in the public imagination, has come to absorb those lost dreams of what independence could have brought if a more revolutionary process had happened in the transition from colony to independent nation state. And if you look up in any search engine the trial of Dedan Kimathi, which is of course what you'd sort of expect the book to be called, but we sort of couldn't call it that, because if you look that term up, that phrase up in any database, what you'll find is the very famous 1976 play by Michiru Kitai Mugo and Ngugi wa Thiong'o. And that was a landmark play for the ways in which it used a colonial trial, the trial of Dedan Kimathi, which, as I said, the archive of which was not available, to imagine a kind of argument against not only the colonial state, but the continuation of colonial governance practices into the post-colony. And so that was also very important for me in this book, is to get Micheri and Ngugi to contribute in some ways. Mm-hmm. At first, I was worried that they might see it in a kind of adversarial way. Often there's sort of this tension that emerges between what people imagine to be historical fact and what people imagine to be historical imagination. Yes. And especially literary versus kind of, you know, the craft of the historian. And indeed, that's not the way I look at the trial at all. I saw the archival trial as another chapter, not the official chapter, right. Another chapter in the way in which Kimathi can be imagined, Kimathi can be presented. Colonial trials are performative in nature. One of Kimathi's allies, but also sort of rivals for leadership in the Mau Mau Rebellion, was General China. And when he was put on trial for his life, he said this great phrase that he wrote about in his memoir when he was recalling the trial. And he said, "Whether anyone tells the whole truth in a court which is trying him for his life is doubtful. At least I doubt it." And he himself had been put on trial for his participation in the Mau Mau Rebellion, sentenced to be executed, but then got a stay of execution based on an agreement with the colonial state to negotiate surrenders with remaining Mau Mau forest fighters. And so that points to the fact that, you know, there's some self-reflexivity about the fact that this is a performance, both on the part of the state and on the part of the defendants. And so what I'm interested in is not what is true versus what is false, but how this document can reveal different sides of this story, and the way in which Kimathi spoke into the archival record, not only about the Mau Mau movement, but also about his own defense, how he was articulating an argument to the colonial state about why he should not be sentenced to death for leading a movement that he self-described as leading.
Yeah. I mean, trying to read through just directly through the trial transcript is a pretty daunting task, because you have to be able to follow the ins and outs of multiple cross-examinations, of multiple reports and documents. Is there a particular passage in this 200-page transcript that's printed in your book that stands out as being as illuminating something important, or whether a contradiction or something historical that's been missed in this memory?
So it was a question that we had when we were putting together this book. Should we cut out some of the repetition or mm-hmm. some of the varying stories in the archival document to make it a little bit more readable? And I resisted that because that's part of historical work, is weeding through. And one of the most fascinating aspects of this trial is the fact that you hear the same story told slightly differently multiple times mm-hmm. About his capture in particular. And navigating through that is the work of historians, is how we come to make meaning. Documents don't just speak to us unmediated. We have to put on our interpretive lenses in order to pull that information out. So I thought that was really important to present in its fullness. Otherwise, it would have been my version of the trial. Right. Yep. And certainly I put annotations in there. So there's a bit of my voice involved in the annotations, but the actual trial transcript, even in the strange layout of some of the transcript, we tried to reproduce mm-hmm. As accurately as possible. In terms of the particular aspects that stand out, there's a couple moments that stand out to me. One would be the first time Kamathi speaks to the court. The very first time he speaks is to indicate to the court that he cannot continue with the proceedings on the very first day of the trial because he's in such pain from his recent surgery due to the bullet wound, which was only mm-hmm. A month before. And there's a real desperation in that moment that's quite striking. But the first time he's able to actually speak and tell his own story, he is remarkably forthcoming, but also concise in what he mm-hmm. says. And that struck me. He told a very personal narrative, which was, I guess, not sort of what I was expecting, mm-hmm. Given that he was known as such a statesman. He created the Kenya Parliament in the forest. They would burn their identity cards from the colonial state and create their own identity cards. He had stamps with his moniker, Field Marshal Dedan Kimathi, made so that he could stamp his letters and have this kind of officialdom around the documentation that he was producing. And yet on trial, he was very much so presenting a very personal narrative, and in particular told a very personal story about struggling with epilepsy since he was a child. And that was quite a striking moment in the trial. That's certainly something I had never heard associated. Yeah.
The fact that he had epilepsy was not something that was a part of the historical record up to this moment.
No. And the only defense witnesses that are brought in to speak on behalf of Kamathi are brought in to speak on that issue. His mother, mm-hmm. one of his friends who witnessed an epileptic fit, the doctor who talked about his medical condition. They're all geared towards this. And the reason this is so central is because it's part of his defense that he was actually surrendering at the time of his arrest and that he suffered an epileptic fit due to the trauma of the shooting. Mm-hmm. And that's why he believed he had said that he had come in to surrender. And that if he hadn't, it was because of an epileptic fit. So this evidence was crucial to his own defense of why he had a weapon and bullets, which under emergency laws in colonial Kenya in the 1950s was carried with it the sentence of the death penalty, just having bullets on you, just having a weapon on you. But for surrender purposes, you had to bring your weapons in order to gain access to amnesty.
Yeah, well, let's back up, because that is the... So it's illegal to carry weapons under the state of emergency, but the British had put out a notice that people should turn in their weapons if they have them, and the means by doing that was a particular sort of ritual of surrender by holding up some green leaves or something like that. And
the green leaves and also the surrender leaflet, which Kamathi claimed had been destroyed, and much of the documentation that was said to be on him had been destroyed in torrential rains. Mm-hmm. That's the rainy season in Kenya in October when he was captured. So that's very possible, probable. But also, let's remember General China's line that it's doubtful whether anyone on trial for their life tells the whole truth. So it's hard to know whether he was intending to surrender. However, the story that the Home Guard tell of how they came to capture him does not match the evidence, and especially how he comes to be shot belies certain aspects of logic in terms of Kamathi's own story about trying to say that he was surrendering and then being shot by the Home Guard, who wanted to ensure that he would get the reward.
Okay. And there was also, what's interesting is in bringing in this question of whether he had epilepsy and how that might have affected him, there are some other, when we get into the commentary by some of the different authors you invited, they comment on that and what that might mean within a Kikuyu cultural context, let alone what it means in the terms of the trial. Can you say anything about that?
Yeah, that was an aspect I was hoping to actually have a contributor speak directly to. Mm-hmm. And we approached a few people, but due to lots of factors, weren't able. And I hope it's something that someone else picks up in their own research. But it certainly there certainly is evidence that, you know, epilepsy is a highly stigmatized disorder in not only in the colonial period, but also still contemporarily in Kenya. Kamathi himself says it's what the Kikuyu call the devils, having the devils, and is associated with ideas around witchcraft, ideas around insanity, but also ideas around prophecy. And so there's multiple different ways in which local traditions interpret these fits, sometimes as a sign of a leader and sometimes as a sign of someone who is mentally unsound. And in this court case, they were not making a claim to insanity. They were not trying to mount a defense of insanity. The only reason the epilepsy evidence comes in is to explain why his surrender was not clearly articulated to his captors. And so it is one of the aspects that comes out of the trial that I think needs further research and needs someone else to take up the mantle. I think there's a couple of areas that the book raises that certainly have opened up new fields for research in the future that we sort of need to learn more about.
What's another one?
Another one I was hoping to have in the book, but due to the nature of trying to put together an edited volume and keeping all the authors on the same page and everyone having the right time commitments to the publication deadline, was the gender aspect. Mm-hmm. So John Lonsdale writes about this a little bit. Certainly it's something that he's studied in the history of the moral economy of Mau Mau, how gender and generational debates figure quite prominently in Mau Mau thought. So he kind of mentions it, but there's a lot of rich detail in the trial and also just in Kamathi's own life that speak to a kind of gender politics that I think could use a lot more examination. His mother's testimony I found quite compelling in the trial, but it's quite short. And then Time magazine publishes this article depicting her as this gnarled old woman spitting on the ground in front of the courthouse. And this defies all the oral accounts of her kind of staunch disposition outside the courthouse. Yeah. And so I think there's aspects there that deserve investigation, but also the constructions of masculinity and honor that go on within the trial. I think there's more room to explore those topics as well.
Okay. Well, let me throw a couple. So you have, you know, a series of really great essays, as well as your very insightful introduction to this transcript to help frame it, and that's all very necessary. Let me start with this, and then move to another quote by Lonsdale. But Simon Gikandi's essay on Dedan Kamathi, "The Floating Signifier and the Missing Body," and you've alluded to kind of both of those aspects before, and he kind of concludes his essay saying, "Kamathi embodies the tensions that define Kenyan society. He is most forceful when he is a catalytic conduit for the contradictions that others consider as imminent in neo-colonial society. And the post-colonial state fears the haunting of the past or return of the repressed," which is, he's actually kind of almost citing, I think, Achille Mbembe's essay on mm-hmm. the archive and the way the archive is kind of filled with ghosts that need to be contained in some ways. Mm-hmm. And this is a very much a story of such a ghost coming back to haunt us. And then let me turn from there. So we have this question of this floating signifier, this figure that has all this, you know, meaning that is built up around him over mm-hmm. the course of half a century or more. And then Lonsdale kind of concludes with the comment, no civil war has ever simply aligned the honest, earnest champions of the people against the crooked, heartless servants of despotism. Opponents often turn out to be their own twins. And if we are to enter a past country in its own context, with its own tragic set of unanswerable questions, then we have to subvert a subversive history as well. Mm-hmm. So we have a floating signifier, and then we have the historian's task, which, if they're going to be honest, is going to have to maybe cut down some of those significations. And you've alluded to that already, but what are these authors that you included in this volume telling us? Maybe let's start with those two.
Absolutely. Simon Gikandi is a preeminent scholar and a post-colonial theorist and literary critic. And he was a very big supporter of the book from the beginning. I remember having dinner with him when we got some of the contributors together for a meal. And he said that the map that we'd created for the book of the area where Kimathi was captured was the first time he'd seen the town he was born in on a map. Yeah. And indeed, we did have to figure that out, and to, because we wanted all the places mentioned in the trial to be captured in this map. And he said it was the first time he'd seen the place of his birth on a map, and that was very exciting to him. And that was quite fulfilling for me, being someone who comes from working on mapping. Yeah. strange connection to my other work. His chapter on the floating signifier I see as a critical bridge in some ways between the historical imagination and the historical archive, and understanding the ways in which the elusiveness of Kimathi as a figure is exactly what allows it to retain this power, both for those who might want to suppress the image and for those who want to herald it as a prefiguring a kind of new revolution. And he speaks to this what he calls historiographic anxieties that are contained within the record. And in our own conversations, we had a little bit of a joke about historians and our need for footnotes and our obsession with footnotes. He's like, I don't need to footnote this stuff. But we were talking about various elements and, you know, sort of his own experience and his own reading of different literary texts. We sort of were able to match up with different archival records and stories that we'd read. And he was pleasantly surprised to find they matched up so well. and that's really one of the things I come away with in his piece, is that his piece allows us to see the multiplicity of meanings that have been projected onto Kimathi and his legacy, and why it's so important to as he calls it, dislocate the truth claims of different historical narratives. And I find that a really important call. John Lonsdale, being a historian, takes a slightly different approach. And the passage you quoted where he talks about subverting subversive histories is a specific callback to Ngugi wa Thiong'o and Michelle Mugo's amazing foreword that they graciously provided for the text. And there was debate as to whether or not to start the book with this foreword, because it kind of says our work is following the path of a colonial fabrication, that the trial is a farce, and that, you know, the trial document serves us no purpose because it's a colonial invention. And yet it opens up all these interesting dialogues. And indeed, Ngugi and Michere point out numerous aspects of the trial that I found fascinating as well, that point out the contradictions within the performance of colonial justice itself. I think what Lonsdale is speaking to there is a reminder that there's a danger in the romanticization of resistance, of history, of these kinds of historical figures. Certainly there is lots of evidence that speaks to many Mau Mau followers finding Kemathi to be increasingly dictatorial, increasingly autocratic in his rule. He had a very strict code of conduct, very strict ideas about moral discipline, which he did not necessarily follow himself. And indeed, what's so striking about the image of his capture that is presented by him and by the prosecution is just how alone he is in that moment. He no longer has any followers. He no longer has his brother. He no longer has his forest wife. He is completely alone. And that's the image that also resonates with the image that we use for the cover, which, if you crop it just to his face, is one of the most famously used images across Kenya and across Africa. Sort of the Che Guevara image that gets put on all the t-shirts. And when I asked Kenyan friends about the image, and I have a t-shirt, so I wear it and I ask people about it, none of them know it comes from his trial, from him sitting in the docks. And when you zoom out, you can see he's got a blanket covering him. He's actually in hospital garb, and he's got handcuffs on his wrists, which is not the full image, right? And so this kind of truncating of the image is part of that process between what John Lonsdale and Simon Gikandi both were arguing, this ability to make him floating, his head floating in that way. Speaks to what you can then project. So people have often said that he has a really stern and resolute look on his face, but when they see the whole photo, they think it's more sad, despondent, and perhaps still under the influence of drugs and the medical conditions he was suffering from. So again, that kind of speaks to those aspects. That nuance might not serve popular contemporary movements in the same way as the heroic romanticized image would.
Yeah. Wow. Well, let's leave it there for this book. And maybe just to close up for the New Books Network, we like to ask what you're working on now, or what are you looking forward to at this point?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to hopefully getting tenure. I'm up for tenure this year, so we'll see. I'm actually really looking forward to, in all seriousness, in 2 weeks I'll be in Kenya doing two book launches for the Kemathi book in Kenya. One in Nyeri, where Kemathi was from, and one in Nairobi. And this has been a long time coming, and I'm very excited that it's coming together. And it's members of Kemathi's family are going to come, the Kemathi Foundation, members of the judiciary, members of the scholarly community. So I'm really excited to be able to bring the book back in that way.
That's really exciting. What is the date of the event in Nairobi?
The Nairobi event is on February 21st, and the Nyeri event is February 18th, which is the anniversary of his death.
Okay, so if you can make it to Nyeri, February 18th, if you can make it to Nairobi, February 21st, where will it be in Nairobi?
In Nairobi, it'll be at the USIAU, the U.S. University of Africa, in Nairobi, and in Nyeri at the Dedan Kemathi University of Technology.
Excellent.
Which has a specific Mau Mau library. And so we'll be donating some of the books, but also being able to invite members of the Mau Mau Veterans Association, who actually took me on a tour of the site where Kemathi was captured. I was able to imagine and sort of put the trial transcript into place and space on the boundary of the Aberdaris Forest. So that was really important to me. And so it'll be great to be able to invite them and honor them and their contributions to this text. So that's next. And the project I'm working on now is builds off my earlier work and my interest in these kind of dissenting ideas around decolonization. And focuses on the alternative mappings of independence. During the period of 1950 to about 1976, I'm looking at the multiple alternative ways that people imagined decolonization could come, what forms it could come, who could claim sovereignty, how the colonial borders that had been imposed and shifted the nature of political communities in Eastern Africa, how they could be changed and altered to reflect communities' desires, and how those alternative projects and those alternative mappings of decolonization were eventually subsumed under the kind of triumphant narrative of the nation state, but also looking at the ways in which that didn't erase those alternative constructions of community and the way they still persist today in the way people move across borders, in the way people formulate kinship networks, and in many of the separatist and secessionist movements we still see unfolding in Eastern Africa.
Yeah, well, that sounds fantastic. And we look forward to that work. I know you have a recent article in the American Historical Review, AHR, that if people want to get a sense of what your work is about currently. Well, let's wrap it up. And I thank you for your time. And I really look forward to these events later this month, February 18th and February 21st in Nyerere and in Nairobi, Kenya, for the launching of this book. Thank you, Julie.
Thanks so much, Paul.